Welcome to Tiny House Tales, a podcast about the experiences of people who have joined the tiny house movement. I'm John Weisbarth.
And I'm Zach Giffen. Enjoy as we give listeners a behind-the-scenes glimpse into the absolute joys and inherent challenges of living tiny.
Together, we'll seek to unlock the successful strategies for minimalist living and learn more about how tiny living has made a big impact on people's lives.
Entertaining and informative, Tiny House Tales is mandatory listening for anyone who has ever dreamed of downsizing or has simply craved a more simple lifestyle.
Welcome to Tiny House Tales. Nailed it.
Was that pretty good? Did I nail it?
I mean, yeah. I guess you got to tell our listeners why you're howling like a wolf now.
Because I'm wild, wild animal. That's why. No.
That's nope, not true.
Well, okay.
You're like a domesticated puppy. Okay.
All right. Well, I'm trying to invoke the wildest side of me because for today's episode, we got a pretty wild tale. We're talking about wolf dogs, and we're talking about apex therapy. Is that right? Did I say that right? Well,
yeah, you did. What we're talking about is veterans suffering from PTSD. Our friend Drew Robertson, who started
Mattersville,
a nonprofit called Mattersville, centered around tiny houses, housing for veterans, and then has expanded into, as you say, this PAC-22, which is wolf dog rescue.
Yeah.
That then combines with being therapy animals for veterans. It's really, it's kind of amazing and beautiful how all of these different things are interconnected, all to serve a really, really meaningful purpose. It's pretty fascinating, actually.
Yeah, it's kind of an unbelievable story. And if we tried to just tell you about it, you probably wouldn't even believe us at all. So we might as well just, you know, move aside and bring in the man himself and let him kind of let you know what it's all about. So, shall we do that, John?
Yes, Zach. Well, Drew, thank you so much, man, for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for your patience with me getting reconnected here.
Oh my God. It was so funny. So I've never met you before, but I was doing a little research on you and I was like, God, there's something so familiar about this guy, Drew. And I'm like, oh, he reminds me of Zach. So of course you would have technical issues because I mean, I'm so at home with it. That's my experience with Zach. I love it.
I thought you were going to comment on the fact that we're both like highly capable, highly motivated, completely passionate. I mean, these kind of things. Instead, you're just focusing on our technical incapacities.
No, 100%. It's all of the things. It's the genius with the technical issues as well. So I can already tell this is going to be a good conversation because I feel so comfortable.
Yeah, it'll be great as long as everybody's prepared for the technology to keep breaking down around us. It's because we're so intense that everything just starts to fail around us. It's totally not our fault.
Mm.
Absolutely.
I like that. Absolutely. I like that. It's because the greater forces of the universe, they're trying to shut us down because we have too much to say. I think I'm going to roll with that. Cool. Yeah.
Well, let's not waste any time, but I will say this. Actually, we are going to waste a little time because Zach was telling me an interesting story, Drew, about the first time he met you at a tiny house festival.
Pocket monkeys.
Yeah. He kept saying pocket monkeys. And I'm like, well, that's not a real thing. So I got to hear the story. What's a pocket monkey? And what does that have to do with the first time you guys met?
Sugar gliders, which are marsupials. A lot of people relate them to flying squirrels, but flying squirrels are rodents. But yeah, I have five sugar gliders as pets as well. They're very, very small. So there's a company out here in the U.S. that sells them called Pocket Pets that, you know, it's kind of like, they sort of just sell them something that I didn't stay involved in for too long because I didn't like their process, but it was really cool. The animals are awesome. And but they kind of got to go with you everywhere. So, you know, they'll ride in a little pouch in your shirt and stuff like that. And so the first time I met them, yeah, I had five sugar gliders literally on me at the time. And so I would let them out every now and then to, you know, to run around, and we'll do little tricks and stuff. I still have them. They're actually here with me right now. So same one.
I'm really glad to hear that you still have your pocket monkeys or sugar gliders, because they're so cute that it seems like it should be illegal. Like, they are the most adorable animal. If anybody that's listening to this wants to just like get crushed by how cute something can be, just go on and like check it out online. You will not be sorry.
Yeah, keep the podcast going in the background, but look at it online. Yes.
Well, yeah. Their commitments, just like any other animal, you know, and one thing I would tell everybody is, like, even though they're small, if you're not ready to give that animal like the attention that they need, and again, they're not rodents, they're marsupials, and they require a totally different type of attention. So, you know, that was the kind of issue with the industry, is everybody thought they're so darn cute. And, you know, and they would buy them and adopt them and thinking that they were going to hold on to them, not realizing that those cute little critters are going to live for about 17 years. So it's a long commitment.
It's not a goldfish is what you're telling me. It's not a goldfish.
Not a goldfish. Correct.
Drew, this is relevant. Your sugar glider pocket monkeys, because of your connection with animals, which ultimately has gotten you to Pack 22, which is one of the reasons we brought you on to talk about that. Here's what I want to ask you. You know, talking about this organization, Pack 22, that you started, your connection to this mission is not through a shared experience, perhaps, but it's a very personal connection to lead you to start this. Can you tell me a little bit about your buddy Randy and what led you to starting Pack 22 and what it is?
Yeah, absolutely. Pack 22 is a byproduct, kind of. It's a group out of our organization, Mattersville, which Mattersville started itself as veteran housing. You know, we wanted to pull that all in and help veterans that were struggling with PTSD or at risk of suicide. After one of my closest friends back in 20, you know, his service takes him back much further, 8 years of service in the Marine Corps, but, 2013, we lost him to PTSD suicide. It was a pretty, pretty shocking tragedy among, you know, our entire group of friends and, you know, family members. And so we were, you know, even more shocked that there was, you know, that the crisis was as big as it is. 22 veteran suicides a day was what we started to learn in our research. And it was like, oh my God, you know, wow, you know, it was just kind of incredible. So we began, you know, looking for different programs and projects that offered positive coping skills for, you know, people that were involved in it. And I think everybody kind of knows and hears about it all the time, but animals and the impact that animals make on people's mental health, and from service animals to just a support animal that you pet and, you know, play with and whatever else. So the opportunity to not just be around them, but rescue those animals and not only help your own mental health, but help those animals and their mental health and getting rehabbed, resocialized, and everything just kind of became one of the best, you know, positive coping skills for our veterans. So we ended up coming up with Pack 22, and Pack 22 is the builders. They're the rescuers. They're the, you know, veteran team members and volunteers, you know, within our organization that have that same, you know, passion for animals and that also get, you know, a strong mental health benefit to the work that they do. It became the most popular program that we had was, the Heroes and Hybrids program, as we call it, and Pack, you know, run by our Pack 22 team. From driving across the country to do these wolf dog rescues that nobody wants to do because shelters are overrun, overcrowded, overworked right now. Taking a veteran on the road for those rescues, South Carolina last week, my favorite, you know, my favorite and longest rescue we ever went on was to Alaska. It was all Zach's fault, like I tried to mention earlier.
Well,
but
before we just blame me for all of your most incredible adventures, I think we should back up and just explain to the listeners a little more about Pac-22, because at least from my understanding, you know, it's essentially utilizing rescued wolf dogs, which are not necessarily legal pets in a lot of different states. And a lot of places, they are taken in by people that can't necessarily handle it or don't know what they've gotten themselves into. Right. It's a big responsibility being the caretaker of a wolf dog. And so a lot of the wolf dogs end up kind of in pens where they're not necessarily living their best life. From what I've understood about your program, it's essentially combining the need to do rescue missions and then utilizing the wolf dogs and enabling veterans that are experiencing PTSD or otherwise to be able to have experiences alongside the wolf dogs that are really profound and it's therapeutic. And so can you elaborate just a little bit more about like the big idea behind that combination?
Yeah, and it's, you know, working beside the wolf dogs, working face to face with the wolf dogs. It's a pretty intense situation where you've got, for instance, a new rescue where at first the animal doesn't accept you, to then getting them to their place of safety and putting them in a constant routine. All from work, you know, that you're putting in and watching them go from this kind of like a story, you know, storybook beast villain, you know, to this incredible animal that wants nothing more than you to visit it again and become part of its pack and, you know, then become part of your pack. It's the same thing that our veterans that are in the program are going through. You know, they had been brought up by, you know, first their families, they had their pack, you know, whether, you know, how, you know, wherever they grew up, then they, you know, 18 joined the military, everything else. And then they're assigned a new pack and, they learn to lean on each other, trust each other, everything else. So they, you know, so they have their pack there. And then it's after the military, it's once they discharge that for the first time in their life, they have no pack. So when they get discharged, they're not given orders on what to do next, how to take care of their mental health, how to take care of their physical health. The orders stopped coming in. So a lot of people get lost without that pack mentality, as we people are pack creatures as well. So the work with the animals is not just just for the animals. Again, it's the work that goes into it and creating that trust and bond that's mutually shared and goes both ways that leads us to what we call pack healing. And that's, you know, one of the biggest parts of our program and one of the most misunderstood too, because you know, people are like, oh, it's all about the animals. I'm like, no, it's all about the relationships. Well, there's so many animals. Yes, that's the crisis we're in an animal world, and why we push ourselves so hard to, you know, do as much as rescues and everything else that we do is because that great need and that great crisis, and nobody else doing what we do in a way that helps them get future homes. You know,
Drew. It, when you talk about this connection between the veterans and the wolf dogs, it is so obvious. It makes so much sense. But I wonder, was it always obvious to you that this connection was there? Or how did you come to think like, oh, yeah, this is similar. This is a good pairing. Because when you talk about it, it makes sense. But I don't know that I could reach that conclusion before, you know, actually doing it.
It's kind of funny how this got sort of laid on us, but the Rocky Mountain Wildlife Foundation in Colorado was set for closure due to the owner, you know, the founder of that foundation being a little too old. The property was a lease. It was, you know, free property, but the, you know, that was kind of ending with the prior owner. They didn't want to, you know, have new ownership come in. So all these wolf dogs, you know, high content wolf dogs and wolves were getting ready to be displaced. So I was on my way there to talk about three of them to be therapy animals for our housing program and everything else. And to me, it also seems obvious, you know, so, you know, because immediately I'm just like, yeah, three, you know, therapy wolf dogs, you know, we'd have plenty of time for them. No, we can get them big enclosure. They'll have the best life. The owner just kind of, his name was Mark Johnson, and he's still doing okay to this day. He had to move to a warmer climate and out of the mountains because it just wasn't doing him very well. But I'll never forget the sound of his voice. He's, you know, he wanted them all to stay together. And I was the only organization that stepped forward that had enough people to do it. And, you know, just the tone of his voice was, you have to keep them together. You've got to. You don't know what it's going to do to them if you have to separate them. And I was just like, well, you know, like, I, you know, let me talk to the team. And I called our board of directors from the parking lot. And, you know, each individually, we had a whole list of questions. And I was just like, well, you know, this guy's really losing it. He needs, you know, he kind of needs an answer. Like he was terrified for the dogs, the wolf dogs. And he told me all the background stories about, you know, some of the different dogs, including the one that was kind of their primary ambassador. Her name was Cheyenne the Healing Wolf. And actually she was known because she could sniff out cancer. And she even diagnosed Mark Johnson's late wife, who was lost to that same cancer. She had a tendency to nibble wherever there was cancer on somebody's body. And it was kind of her saying, you know, that something's there, something's wrong. And she apparently was right 100% of the time. And I'm like, holy cow. I mean, if this dog could sniff this out, but not only that, they can tell when you're in a bad mood, if they can really just vibe with you in that kind of way, like there's something big here behind what they can do for mental health. And, you know, again, I'm not a doctor, but, you know, maybe I just saw them better from the eyes of a patient, you know, because again, like there's, you know, when it comes to the work, I not only see, but I felt the true benefits of working with those first animals. And, you know, and then when I became when I adopted my first wolf dog as compared to, you know, a regular dog, again, it's a different bond. They, you know, the amount of trust they put into only certain people, it's something that you have to earn. And if you misstep or break that trust with those animals once, it's going to take you months to get back to where you were with their trust. You know, and it could be something so silly, like a little misstep, or, you know, they, you know, thought you tried to sneak up on them when, you know, or just anything. They, you know, they're very, by nature, the wolf is pretty distrustful of humans to begin with. So, so you have to earn it. And to get to earn that with an animal that's, you know, apex predator that doesn't yet trust you, you've got to put your guard down to be able to go in there. And again, it's getting your mind on a certain level that allows you to even break your, you know, fight or flight response to go in and, you know, say, all right, you know, we're going to get to a point where you're not, you know, snapping at me or whatever else. Cause again, some of these animals were pretty badly neglected or abused before even getting to us, before we even got the phone call.
Drew, do you think that is a piece of the effectiveness of your program, is that it's not just, you know, a dog, but it's actually an animal that has got a bit of wild still in it. And there's kind of a bit of maybe some danger. Is that one of the factors that makes it kind of more impactful for veterans to have that experience?
You know, working with any feral dog or unsocialized animal is got its inherent dangers, right? Like some would tell you that the most vicious canine out there isn't actually the wolf, but the chihuahua. You know, but it's it really is all about kind of how they're brought up. But I, as far as the veterans and the mental health aspect, I've long thought that that's part of it. You know, if you look at some different coping skills that people have, you know, from jumping out of helicopters and skydiving and, you know, all kinds of things that have to be sort of intense after. Some people that suffer more intense traumas, you definitely see them using more intense methods. To me, the thought of working with, you know, wolves and wolf dogs at first seemed dangerous. When we got down to the work and got down to a strong routine, I realized my bigger concerns aren't necessarily the animals, but people's reactions and how the animals respond to, you know, somebody sort of just, you know, making wrong moves trying to push a relationship on the animal that they're not ready for yet. You know, it's kind of the dog in the corner, you know, theory. You know, again, you push a dog into a corner, eventually they're gonna bite. And we don't let anybody really force a relationship onto the animals, more so than, again, earning it. So it's been incredibly safe. But again, I think that, again, knowing in the back of your mind that that animal has a choice to, you know, whether it's going to, you know, work with you or not, again, kind of keeps people respecting the full situation that they're in when they're in there with the animals. And if they don't, we remind them.
And if you don't remind them, the wolf puppy will remind them.
They definitely can. There's definitely been some warnings before the wrong, you know, like I said, people overstepping, pushing that relationship before the animal's ready, whether they're a rehab or whether that person's just new to that animal. You know, some of them you really have to earn it.
Well, you keep saying that word, you got to earn it. And I think that might be the real thing that is that connection to the veteran. It gives a sense of purpose, right? And I know that's one of the things, purpose, resilience, community is another big thing. And I wonder, you know, you also talked about housing a few times in that. And one of the reasons you wound up on our radar was because of the tiny house aspect to that. I'm curious, how did you come to the idea of housing, tiny houses, community for this underserved group?
Yeah, when we lost my friend Randy to PTSD suicide, the idea of Mattersville originally was just, honestly, it was us at a funeral, at his funeral, and a group of friends that we were sitting around afterwards and talking about what limited resources there are for veterans and everything else. But not only that, you know, as friends, we were all dumbfounded in our own ignorance, you know, of PTSD and what was going on, not just with Randy, but with the military community altogether, with the veteran community altogether, that they were suffering so badly. Again, we started talking about the 22 veteran suicides a day. And then it was like, well, you know, we all need to get together, you know, a little more often, because we had realized, man, it's been years since we all got back together, you know, the old neighborhood group back home. And, you know, it's like, when did we stop checking up on each other to where we let something get this far, where, you know, we're losing our friends to that we're so feeling so awful about their life that they would rather end it than give us a call. You know, and that was that, you know, that was kind of that blame and everything that we were all sort of still experiencing, especially being just after his funeral. And it was then it was like, well, why don't we all chip in on a property off grid somewhere? I was in solar school and everything else. And, you know, learning how to design systems and build systems. And, you know, it was like, well, let's do an off grid property and yada, yada, it'll be cheaper. And we'll all meet there once a year for like a week long camping trip or, you know, something to where we can have something to look forward to, check with our, you know, check in on our families, check in on our friends, you know, again, just have that chance of community, you know, our old community, being back together every year. And then it would probably grow and everything else. But then it was like, okay, so we're going to build cabins. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. Who's going to watch this property of ours, you know, the other, you know, the whole rest of the year, right? The other 50 weeks.
And everybody's like, Drew, we nominate you.
Well, it was like, well, what if we could give a veteran an opportunity to stay on that property and monitor that property? And, you know, then they would have free housing for the year. And we don't care. We just want that one week where we get to check on each other. And then it was, well, who's going to help keep an eye on that veteran and, you know, yada, yada, and everything else. It's like, well, we should put a tiny home on the property and that'll be theirs. That way they're just kind of helping with the grounds. And it's like, well, you know, but who's going to keep them company? You know, who's going to check on them? Who's going to, you know, be there, you know, to make sure that he's okay, whoever this person might be. And then it's like, well, you know, because then I, you know, immediately, again, I'm thinking about Randy. I'm like, now I can't just pull any veteran. It's got to be somebody that is either really self-sufficient or somebody that, you know, or again, a group of people. So then it was like, well, you know, we should do all of that thing, except we should do it, you know, all the time. And, you know, again, maybe just make this a community aspect. Then it just kind of went from there. My buddy Matt played the song Mattersville by NOFX. And it was, you know, if you listen to the lyrics of that song, it was pretty, you know, pretty inspiring to us, because, you know, we kind of had a punk rock childhood, you know, out of the beach growing up in Florida. So it was, you know, the song was very appealing to us for what kind of neighborhood we would want to live in. And that just sort of became the thing. Mattersville was born at Randy's funeral. And, you know, again, everything evolved naturally, I think is the, you know, the important thing.
You know, Drew, when I hear you talk, what comes to mind is the concept of the lone wolf, right? And you talk about, you know, wolves being pack animals, human beings being pack animals or tribal species. And when you kind of use the phrase lone wolf, it brings to mind of kind of a very dangerous creature, right? You know, the lone wolf is the one that might be hungry, that might be desperate, that could potentially do something that's unpredictable. And, you know, what it kind of talks to me, what it tells me is it really speaks to the idea of isolation and how damaging isolation is, whether you are a wolf, right, kept in a pen by itself, away from its pack, or you're a human being that, you know, might feel isolated for whatever reason. And I think in our society, you know, like loneliness and isolation is so damaging on a whole spectrum of levels. But certainly when you're talking about, you know, veterans and PTSD, isolation is a really big piece of that. And also with homelessness, you know, a lot of people think about homelessness as, oh, well, people go and live in tent encampments. But truthfully, when you actually, you know, really get down to it and hear the stories, being homeless is an incredibly isolating experience, even if there's people around, because you kind of end up putting up these walls around you for protection. And my question really is, was homelessness a part of Randy's story, or was housing insecurity a part of it?
No, Randy was never really homeless. Randy is actually quite the opposite. He's one that wouldn't go asking for help. And you know, even if he needed it, but his problem was again the lack of coping skills that led him to getting as far into his PTSD as he went. But the homeless aspect, a lot of people don't realize that a lot of our veterans are not homeless by lack of ability to go out there and make money and everything else. They're homeless because they want that actual seclusion. A lot of them are homeless by choice, because they don't want to go and deal with the type of normal rigmarole that everybody else goes through, dealing with the boss that doesn't want to, you know, doesn't give them the room that they need to have, you know, mental health triggers, things like, you know, you work in a factory with loud noises. Again, it could, you know, things like that can cause flashbacks for a combat veteran, or, you know, certain, you know, all kinds of different scenarios at different, you know, places of employment. Right. So, you know, for some people they're it's not that they can't work or don't want to work or anything else, but maybe just don't have the room to when they're having, any kind of episode or experience that brings them back to that negative place with their PTSD, that they can go and work it out, process for a minute, and then come back and return to their job. That lack of time and space to process, you know, again, it pushes people away from, you know, those types of jobs or general society or whatever else, just because people, you know, are going to, I mean, for how long have people acted like veterans were just crazy, you know, the ones that finally got to the point where they wanted to to be away from people and push away from traditional housing. And, you know, they're far from it. In fact, it's, you know, it's them. And for some of them, it's them trying to protect people, you know, in a way of like, you know, they recognize that they could be dangerous to themselves and they could be dangerous to others. So they keep a distance. They keep a wide berth from the rest of the people that do not get them. And, you know, that's, and sometimes I think that's easier to say to an animal than it is to a person and a human being. And as well, when, you know, these guys are working with these animals, that's why, you know, again, I feel like it's so effective, is they could be the best therapists, you know, in regards to stuff. So, it's more so the volume of
that. Self-inflicted isolation.
Yeah, the self-inflicted. And so we, you know, and again, the veteran community, or the homeless community, is jam-packed with veterans, I think, for that reason. And again, most of them are going to be the reason that it always stays a high number of veterans is they're going to be the last ones to go sign up and ask for help and everything else, because they're immense pride. And it's kind of funny because, again, there's so much pride there. If you ask and you offer, or if you just extend a hand, they'll take it. But they're, you know, and again, they'll work it, and they'll be skeptical because our veterans have been promised a lot in the past. And the people, you know, or the country or the government has not always delivered for them.
Drew, let me ask you about, in terms of the tiny house aspect of what you do with Mattersville, are you guys purchasing those? Are you building those? Is it a hybrid? Is it a little bit of both? What is the situation with basically acquiring the tiny houses?
So it's always been a crapshoot. Operation Tiny Home has been one of our biggest contributors to our tiny houses. Yep, it's Gabrielle is just incredible. Sometimes she, you know, sometimes donors will reach out to her about, you know, some DIYs that didn't come together the way people had hoped. Or one time she found one that was on a showroom floor in Vegas, you know, with the Tiny Home Builders Association. And, you know, there was all kind of, you know, it was a mix and match materials. And we're like, okay, well, we'll see what we could do of just putting the rest of it together. And, you know, but they, you know, Gabrielle just, it's like, you know, you got anybody that could drive across the country and go pick up a tiny home, and we'll go and do it. And then we'll start working on them, finishing them, and or, you know, rebuilding them. But then there's also, like a hybrid of where we also have about a team of people working with our COO, Will. He'll put together different projects and we'll work on, just brand new ones. We're finishing a stick build right now. That's a stick build, one bedroom, little tiny home with a loft called the Walden Cabin. That one's for a veteran named Dave, who's a really, really awesome guy, who's 82nd Airborne Division. And he's been with us for a couple of years now. So he both has a DIY rebuild that he's working on wheels, and then he's got the one that's on you know, pylons stick building as we speak. So he wants both worlds, because he wants to be a nomadic but also wants to finally have a little bit of roots.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite parts about your story, Drew, is that, you know, you kind of mentioned Operation Tiny Home. When I first met you, when I was so impressed with your pocket monkeys, I was
sugar gliders.
I was at a tiny home festival in Colorado with Operation Tiny Home, which is a nonprofit that I've been a part of. And Gabrielle, the executive director, was there as well. And I think, you know, at the time we were doing mostly programs where we were going around the country and constructing tiny homes and bringing veterans together to build the tiny home in like 3 days and then kind of finishing after we left. It was fantastic program. But then when COVID hit, of course, we couldn't do that. And so Operation Tiny Home, we had to shift. And one of the big shifts that we made was we kind of started a different program called the Pathways to Tiny Housing Program, which is essentially where we are in a facility in Oregon constructing tiny homes and then providing them to, at a discounted rate to organizations like Mattersville. And I think that actually we have a home that is going to one of your villages probably in March, I think.
But when does this episode air?
Who knows?
Hopefully we'll get it out before then.
The recipient doesn't know.
Oh, okay.
I think you're safe.
Yeah, the recipient doesn't know that's on its way. And we're super excited about that because the individual that will be moving into that house is one of the most deserving individuals that I've ever met. As a veteran, as a rescuer, as a human, they deserve it. And it's gonna be one of the cooler ones because they are the last person that would ever ask for something like that for themselves. So it's going to be extra special given that one.
Okay. So just so I know, because one of the things I was going to say is that it's just so cool to see where you were when I first met you and you were talking about this idea, you were trying to create this village Mattersville to then expanding into the PAC-22, getting a lot of traction and just attention through the work that you were doing there. And now you've been expanding, right? You have properties in multiple states. Can you tell us a little bit about that journey?
I can. It's been, well, so at first we started with partnerships, people offering their properties to do stuff. And I would look at a lot of the properties and they would work. And we've been burned sometimes. And then we've been, we've been successful in others. We started building out in Wisconsin and Florida, and those properties were partnership properties where we were allowed to do stuff. We were allowed to pull up with tiny homes and different things, but zoning wasn't going to fit long term. So when we first started, some of them we would get going and then realize, halfway in that, instead of county, there was some other this, that, or the other. So we've actually probably gone through more trial and error than I would have preferred. But it's led us to where we've gotten really effective at getting things done and making the plans and then what to look for. Our first property in Sedalia was, which actually after that day I met you at the People's Tiny House Festival, it was like 1 week later, the property offer for our first property came in. So I was literally just selling, trying to sell the dream, telling people what we wanted to do. And then somebody was like, I've got a property. It's got, all these issues, all these problems. You're going to have your hands full. It's going to suck. And it's just like, I'll take it, I'll take anything because I wanted to start, So we had to remove 300,000 pounds of trash from that property. It was totally wasted in the mountains. And we one trailer at a time, loaded it up, volunteers, cleaned it up, built some wolf dog enclosures and started bringing them in. And then it just kind of went nuts. But other situations were like Florida. We had built a property in Florida with a partner there. She had a smaller property, wasn't going to fit too many tiny homes unless we were able to literally increase the land. So we built and we got, a couple spots rebuilt and had some campers and other units because we ended up doing this huge 50 wolf dog rescue in a 2 week period because of a fire. And so we kind of mobilized that in a instant situation and we weren't planning on necessarily being there forever, but we ended up turning that back over recently because all the wolf dogs have been relocated to our main locations and it was too much to manage without having the ability to put more, like several more tiny homes on the property, and space wise that property wouldn't have fit. So we had a plan to, instead of properties that other people owned and that were, giving us rights or building rights or whatever else to, the idea was to get to where the organization owned the properties. And so we worked on raising for other properties that were under our ownership. So now we're getting ready to expand to another 35-acre property in Hartzell. We have a property in Yoder that was donated to us by a deceased individual named Wolfman Greg, who was lost in a fire on the property, and his executor, after we rescued his wolf dogs, They wanted the property to stay with him. So we were donated a 40-acre little ranch property. And that's the one we're working on right now, putting all the, you know, all kinds of, all the tiny homes, finishing all the tiny homes. I've got a couple containers on site that I've rebuilt into infrastructure, you know, containers. So, you know, power and water, cistern systems and animal care shed and big, huge tool shed in a container. And so we started building it out sort of with the long term plans of Mattersville in mind of little microgrids all over the property of my little solar arrays that battery banks that power each unit separately. And it's all, all on compost and tank systems. So we didn't have to have some huge waste system set up, and it's pretty awesome. So, and then next year we're hoping to additionally move into North Carolina, going out east and, another mountain property near Asheville that we're looking into again, unrestricted zoning, has a stream, flowing water, you know, something. We found a few properties and we've narrowed it down to just a couple.
You know, Drew, it strikes me that what started as sort of one thing to help maybe your group of friends in the wake of a tragedy and how it has grown and morphed and developed into all these other positive things. It just kind of reminds me that, one good act can lead to so many other good acts, and each of those acts has a ripple effect. And we talked to a lot of people on this show that to me are so inspiring because they actually go out and do it. And like, just listening to this story about how we screwed it up a couple of times. This wasn't exactly the right thing, but you keep learning and you keep doing it. And I'm so impressed by that. And when I jokingly said that, you know, you were having trouble with the technical difficulties and that you reminded me of Zach, you also remind me of Zach in the fact that you're a doer. And that's one of the things that I think I'm very inspired by. And so not a question, but just a comment to say, like, I appreciate that. And it doesn't go unnoticed.
And I'll add to it in that, you know, you're talking about messing up and you learned a lot. Well, yeah, that's how you learn. That's how you become an expert, right? Is that you try, you see what doesn't work, you see what does, and then you kind of learn from that and you move in the direction of what, you know, what works. And what strikes me when I, you know, hear you talk is like, oh yeah, you're a guy who was going to school for solar. So, right. So you were becoming an expert at, like, you know, solar and working on the kind of off-grid energy aspect. And then now you've kind of followed this kind of weird pathway through becoming an expert in kind of wolf dog rescue. And not only that, but you're talking about microgrids. I mean, you've been building these tiny home villages and talking about, like, how you're dealing with your wastewater and how you're obviously dealing with your energy needs. And, you know, I think that it's, like, so inspiring and also so cool to see that, like, you have really diversified your kind of knowledge base and become an expert in so many different things. I think, you know, if I was somebody who was trying to kind of emulate a plan on, like, how to, you know, help veterans, I think that talking to you and finding out what it is that you've learned along the way would be one of the first things I would do.
I've got some great advice getting started. You know, I was really lucky. Marcus Alvarado, the People's Tiny House Festival, is who where we met you, was actually who introduced me to Gabrielle from Operation Tiny Home. I was fortunate in my first year of a functioning, and I mean, we had a location and everything else at this point, as a functioning nonprofit. She had already been through a bunch of stuff, you know, and she had already had some stories and overcome a whole ton of challenges. And, you know, a lot of people have egos and they don't put them aside to listen, you know, and luckily I was able to, you know, listen to her plan and see, like, here's this organization that's building tiny homes for veterans. And instead of, you know, a lot of people get very competitive. I wasn't competitive at all. I was like, oh my God. So this has to be, like, cause this has to be kind of where it started, you know? And Gabrielle's story with, you know, building her tiny home for a brother of ours, I was inspired. And So picking her brain and what, you know, she had to overcome was what sort of prepared me for everything I was going to eventually have to deal with. You know, starting a nonprofit, you're not going to get paid. You're not going to make money. There's no money in this. Like, anybody that would think that, you know, you can create this great additional life, like it's really, you can't. There's never going to be, you know, this, you know, you're never going to have the golden toilet, as they say. You're going to have tons of work. It's going to be thankless a lot of the time. And you have to literally be able to look at the best in people, because a lot of people will come in thinking that that you're, you know, that they can get what they want out of the programs without putting in, just sort of with an expectation. We've run into some of the wrong element. And again, if you, I try and look at everybody through a different lens, that, you know, what brought them to be this way, to try and think that they'd be able to, you know, to take advantage without working the program, and then, you know, giving them the room to have that error, because it's really hard to describe what we do to a point where it doesn't sound like we're just giving away houses. At the same time, you know, because again, we've had people that show up and like I said, they try and burn us. They're like, hey, where's my house and my wolf dog? And, you know, and where do I park? And it's just like, well, you know, we've got this whole program. There's this whole buildup where your house isn't even an idea yet, because you haven't told us, you know, what is your plans for your future, you know, everything else. So you do have to look past a lot. You have to look past what seems like, you know, people being greedy, but it's a misunderstanding of, you know, the program's intents and stuff like that. But again, there to all the stuff though that we end up having to overcome, the trial and error, as we were just discussing, literally comes from a team aspect, and not just from me. People have had to pull me out of the out of some serious anger moments of those times that we do get burned. And you know, it's not to say that I've always been able to stay collected without the other directors and the other team members, and even the veterans at times kind of, you know, pull me off the ledge, as they say, you know, because it's
well, your pack steps in to help you. We all need a pack.
Yeah. So it is, you know, again, when you, I appreciate that. I guess is the short way of saying, I appreciate the fact that you guys can see, you know, through all the different lenses as well, you know, knowing how, you know, not just one, you know, one tiny home, but, how to make a community flow can be a difficult thing when you're dealing with all these different types of mental health. And that's kind of what I was trying to get to, is there's so many different types of mental health. And, you know, some people, you know, again, you might think they're trying to use you, but they don't understand what, you know, how to utilize the program that you've designed, or, you know, and then there's others that absolutely are just trying to use you, and hopefully you could get them out of the way so that the people that deserve, you know, they're trying to work the program the right way, can push through. But, it could be a lot. It'd be a lot to take in at times here.
Well, you have done an incredible job, and it's so inspiring, like I said, seeing where you were, just this guy with some pocket monkeys and this amazing idea, and I don't even, 6 years ago. And just thank you for what you do. It's been such a journey just kind of witnessing it. And, you know, I think just bottom line, I think more people need to be more comfortable with failure. Right. And have that attitude that you have of just like, hey, not everything's going to work, but we're going to learn from it. We're going to move on and we'll get, you know, better as we go. And I can tell that that's what you're doing.
Drew, where can people get in touch with you to help if they want?
We actually just updated our website. MattersvilleVets.org is the best place to go if you want to volunteer, if you want to schedule a visit. We do, you know, free private tours to anybody that wants to come, and if they want to talk about mental health, that's a service that we, you know, keep available for everybody. Yes, you will be in, you will see the wolf dogs. If you go on one of the tours, you'll see a lot of them. And, yes, you'll probably end up making contact with them too. So, it's an amazing experience that again, we'll always keep available, to private visits, so that people, And anybody can schedule those, because we want people to be able to, like we said, you know, Randy, my friend that we lost, he never reached out to anybody. He never let us know what was going on. And if you know, anybody finds themselves in that situation, we want you to reach out. We want you to schedule a tour, schedule a visit, come volunteer, but reach out, come talk to us so that we can help you, you know, and we can find some positive coping skills of your own and hopefully prevent unnecessary loss of great people.
100%. Drew, thank you so much for your time. Absolute pleasure. I still think you and Zach are very similar, and I mean that in all the good and all the crazy.
Well, I hope once he comes out here to Colorado for another visit, we can get him out on the slopes, because I've always heard about what an incredible skier he is too. So I'll be on the snowboard, but I'm going to see if I can keep up, because you know he's kind of turned into a legend. So
well, I will definitely take you up on that, and that is absolutely my brand of crazy. So we'll get it done. All right, Drew.
Awesome.
Thanks so much,
guys.
So you didn't believe me. I told you it was going to be awesome.
You said pocket monkeys. I believed you was going to be awesome. I didn't believe pocket monkeys.
Well, okay, but you
can't. I guess I was wrong.
But you can't. I mean, marsupial and like, what was it? Sugar glider?
Yeah.
So don't go Googling pocket monkeys, everybody, but check out sugar gliders, because they are just about the cutest animal possible. And after you're done, definitely check out Pack 22 and see some pictures of the wolves, because... Yeah, it's, you know, you can think about like what it might be like to get into a pen with a wolf that's not exactly domesticated. And then when you actually see the pictures, it's it kind of sinks in a little more. So I would definitely recommend it.
They do look so lovable when they're like, when you look at the video and they're like, oh, it's so cute. But then you kind of like, but you get a sense of the size. Like, these are big animals, you know, but I really... I love that work, and I love that you know, we didn't really get into it, but the idea that really it starts with housing. It starts with a tiny house, and then that ability.
Well, that's the foundation.
Exactly.
Right. The housing is the foundation on so many of these different projects. I feel like, you know, it's the kind of the common denominator that enables all the other efforts to flourish, because, you know, without a stable place to live, I mean, good luck trying to tackle mental health, right? It's people are completely distracted, and I think that's what it really comes down to.
Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Shelter, number one. You got to take care of that before you can worry about any of the other things. Yeah, Zach, I looked it up on the internet. It's called being smart. Thanks, Google.
I don't think that qualifies, actually. That's
nope, it does.
Maybe resourceful. Definitely qualifies as resourceful. Nope. I'll give you that.
Smart. Got it. Nailed it. Speaking of smart, Zach, smart thing to do. Wrap this up.
All right.
Great seeing you again, buddy.
It was great. You too.
Happy skiing.
We'll do it again.
Okay. Bye.
We'll do. Bye.